District of Michigan, a seat which he had held for some 25 years. He had never run for statewide office in Michigan, and he had never run for national office. He had no personal constituency. And such authority as he brought to the presidency derived entirely from the sigh of relief which swept the nation when Mr. Nixon left the White House for his palatial estate at San Clemente. The American people were glad that Nixon et al. Were no longer in the White House, and pleased that a Mr. Clean, a man who had been in public office for almost three decades and to whom no taint of scandal had ever been associated, that such a man finally occupied the desk in the Oval Office. Now, Gerald Ford is not a man who has many illusions about himself. He's not a very pompous man, nor is he very much involved in building his own immortality. And he knew this set of facts as well as any of us. And when he was sworn in that Friday morning in a very moving, short ceremony, he said as much to the American people. You have not elected me as your president with your ballots, so I ask you to confirm me as your president with your prayers. And I suspect that the vast majority of American people, whatever their political preferences or persuasions may be, offered their prayer that day that Mr. Ford would rise to this high office. For we were sick of Watergate, of enemies lists, of illegal wiretaps, of the washing of campaign funds, of the abuses of power. We were sick of a presidency which was being managed for nothing more than to maintain one man in power. We were urgently concerned that inflation, recession, the terrifying problems of race, the human problems which face our nation, that these should be faced and dealt with, as well as the lingering insecurities of the international order. Mr. Ford that day represented, hopefully, not only a new man, but a new spirit. And I'm sure we pray that he would bring with him a new team. They would clean out the Augean stables, remove from office, from position, from administration, anyone who had been at all associated with Mr. Nixon. And I know that I, for one, that day hoped that he would associate with himself for these last two plus years of this administration men and women of highest order of ability and proven competence from all sides of the political spectrum in the United States, so that we could confront the domestic issues which lay before us. I was hoping that he would announce that day a cabinet or a ministry of many talents, and he would bring into Washington new faces, new men, new ideas, as well as a new spirit. Unfortunately, in my mind, Mr. Ford, those first few weeks of administration, missed a golden opportunity. Instead of bringing in new men, he kept the old men. It was a matter of habit, congressional habit. It was a matter of personal preference. He'd risen to the positions he had occupied in the House, lastly as the minority leader of the House, by following the rule of working hard and doing what must be done for the good of the whole, of getting along by going along. And he knew that it was an unwritten rule of the Congress that if a man after a number of terms in office was voted out of office, some federal appointment would be found for him, and other congressmen and senators would absorb the people from his staff. No one is rudely dismissed from position. There must be a concern for their employment, for their families, and the like. And Mr. Ford brought those kinds of concerns with him to the White House. Instead of being a new broom that sweeps clean, he kept around himself those who had been there, One or two have trickled away in the subsequent weeks, but for the most part, at most middle and lower levels and in some of the higher levels of the administration, the people who were there were the people who were there during the Nixon days. In fact, his only first rank appointment was that of Nelson Rockefeller, to occupy the vice presidency which he had vacated. And I can't think of an appointment which might have been more laden with booby traps for the new president. For despite Mr. Rockefeller's proven record as a Republican vote-getter in New York State, he was a man who was associated with plutocracy, with great wealth. He was a man of whom most ordinary Americans were deeply suspicious, as they are suspicious of all people of unusual wealth or unusual power. In a democracy, one must be suspicious of a king who can buy his own court, who can hire the best minds in the major universities to enter his government because he can or is willing to supplement their income or to pay their traveling expenses or to give them rich presents or trusts for their children. The idea of a royal officer who hires his courtiers is foreign to the American spirit and has proven to be a terrible obstacle on the way to the confirmation of Mr. Ford's one major appointment. Unfortunately, in those first days in office, he proved to be more of an old crony, of a congressman, than he did of a new president. And he lost the opportunity to draw to himself men and women from many orders of our country, for a country rich in people of ability. The old faces are there, and the new problems are simply being magnified day by day. Gerald Ford has not been able to build a new administration. There's been a change at the top, but not all the way down the line. He's proven to be an honest man. He's proven to be a man of great energy. But he's proven to be a man who's partisan, who's burdened and limited by the traditions of party loyalty. Another way of saying that, he's burdened by the traditions of cronyism. And he further lost much of the original wave of hope which surged with his entry into the presidency when, some 2.5 weeks after he had assumed that office, he acted as if he were a medieval pope granting a total absolution to some royal opponent who now had bent his knee to the church. When he absolved Mr. Nixon of all responsibility before the court for any action which he may have carried out during his presidency. We had hoped that Mr. Ford would be a man who would consult with men of judgment. He acted impulsively. We had hoped that he would put as much distance as possible between himself and Mr. Nixon, instead of which we found that he had pardoned Mr. Nixon, and more than that, that he had given to Mr. Nixon the keys, control, to the now notorious tapes and to the other records of his stint in the presidency. Now, there are several serious consequences of this act. The first was not only that Mr. Nixon would escape responsibility before the bar of justice for his actions, and that those who were at the second level, the Haldemans, the Ehrlichmans, the Mitchells, would probably escape from their day in court because a jury would not be tempted to find guilty the second level of command in a conspiracy if the President of the United States had already pardoned the man who had ordered and organized and managed and for whose benefit the conspiracy had in fact taken place. But more than this, perhaps more damaging than this, Mr. Ford had damaged his own credibility. For it turned out that some 8 days before he had assumed office, General Haig, representing Mr. Nixon, had visited with the then vice president in his office and that the issue of a presidential pardon had been raised. Gerald Ford is an open man, and he is willing to meet, and he went before a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee 10 days ago, and he told them under oath that there had been no deal. But the issue had been raised, and much can be agreed on between men without the words actually being spoken. And the suspicion remained among the American people that there was an agreement between Ford and Nixon, and that Mr. Ford was simply paying off his end of the bargain which raised him to the presidency of these United States. Be this as it may, we found ourselves with a president who was not simply Mr. Clean, but who was honorable but partisan, honorable but tied with heavy ties to the previous administration. The hope for a new start was shattered, and Americans had to reassess the possibilities of the future and lower by many times their expectations of the future. Mr. Ford is a strong man. He's vigorous, good-looking, tall, square-chinned. He's as functional and as sturdy and as unsophisticated as the furniture which made his native Grand Rapids so famous. He's never been a man who has been noted for brilliance. The man has been noted for loyalty and for energy and for a basic decency. You'd like him. I like him. He likes people. He's not the man who's going to build a phalanx of secretaries and minions between himself and his advisors, between himself and the American people. But he has a rather peculiar turn of mind, or rather his mind doesn't turn over very often. He's the most incurious human being I've ever met. He'd rather play golf than read a book. He'd rather talk with old friends than attend a briefing. He said it himself the other day. He was asked by some interviewer why he spent so little time at his desk in the White House. His answer was, "I do my best thinking before the television set." I had a personal experience with this turn of mind. Some 2.5 years ago, you recall, the Zionist organization gave Mr. Ford the Abba Hillel Silver Memorial Award in this very building. And for about 30, 35 minutes before the meeting, he was in my office and we talked. I was interested in many things about Washington, and I asked a few questions. I received a few very noncommittal, brief replies. I thought Mr. Ford might be interested in Cleveland, in Ohio, and some of our economic and racial problems, some of my interests in Israel, my concerns for Israel. He was not interested. Instead of which, he spent 30 of the 35 minutes telling me that one of the congressmen from his delegation from Michigan had just divorced his wife. And it was a terrible thing, and that Congress put terrible strains on marriages and on families. And he went on to enumerate this one and that one in the congressional delegations and some of the problems that they were having. I must say, my heart went out to that particular congressman. And his did too. But that's hardly the level at which I expect a man who's concerned with issues of state to want to use his opportunity. I suspect we'll hear many stories as we used to hear of General Eisenhower when he became president, of how he would send men hither and yon around the world to spend weeks and months building up dossiers of information for his understanding, and then when he would invite them into the Oval Room for their 50 minutes for a briefing, he would spend the first 45 reminiscing with them of places they had been together, the family that they shared, or friendships which they shared. You'll like him, but you'll wonder about him. Mr. Ford reminds me of that stamp that many government bureaus have, which places on a piece of paper, in a document, the phrase, the right to know, the need to know, which means that only those with a need to know have a right to read this document, only if they're involved in the implementation of a particular policy. He has a built-in sensor. It says, do I have a need to know this? And if he doesn't, he turns it off. He's remarkably poorly read. He's remarkably poorly traveled. Here is a man who was in Washington for 25 years in some of the most important positions in our government, who's never been to Asia, who's never been to Africa, who's never been to South America, who has not really wanted to go to Europe. He didn't go junketing because he had no interest in what he'd find there. Everything he needed to find could be found on the Burning Tree golf course or in the homes of his friends, on fishing trips, and Vail. He's a remarkably little furnished mind. And because of that, this essentially good man keeps repeating the platitudes which he learned as a youngster. And he becomes, therefore, to his contemporaries, more and more of a conservative. He was raised in Grand Rapids, Michigan, during the years before the Great Depression, when God was in his heaven, and American business and American democracy were right for the whole world. And he believes in personal initiative. He's a man of deep piety. He's a man of rock-ribbed honor. He was an Eagle Scout. He's a football player who believed in good sportsmanship. But the books, Strange Ideas, Unusual Experiences, Different Kinds of People, the problems attendant to the increasing complexity and subtleties of modern life, these have simply not been of interest to him. And so, he faces every new situation with the old platitudes. He's not an ideologue. He's not a conservative ideologue like Buckley. He's simply a man whose mind has not grown as the times have changed. But never mistake this innocence for ineffectuality. He's a man whose record in Congress was among the most conservative, if not reactionary, of any that was compiled there. He voted against Medicare and Medicaid. He voted against public housing. He voted against every rise in the Social Security payment, taxes. He voted against Head Start. He voted against mass transit. He voted against every one of the public welfare, social welfare bits of legislation which have been proposed and passed by various Congresses over the last 25 years. And then after he had fought against these issues, he turned around once they became law and he used his position in Washington to see to it that Grand Rapids received its share and more of the funds that were available. He's a very effective politician. He knows what office is for. And there's a certain flexibility to him. He doesn't bear a grudge. He will go along once the position becomes the law. He doesn't try to undo, to remake the 19th century. But he has no vision of the 20th century. He simply does not have the interest which would lead him to imagine, to explore, to develop in his own mind what life now is really all about. Now, there are advantages in all of this. Since he's not an ideologue, he's not given to inflexibility. People can talk to him, and he will be moved by what they say. He may be equally moved by what the next man says. But he will be moved by good advice. And that's why the question of those who surrounded him was so terribly important. And it's really a misfortune that the old mind, the mind that proved inadequate to the problems of the American economy over the last 6 years, are still the minds which invest and infest Washington. He's not an ideologue. He's not inflexible. But give him the right group of people, as he found in Cleveland last week, people of the last century and of great wealth, people of the last century and of a party which in their own minds has not changed. And he will use all of the old cant, all of the old language, and it will seem as if this is not 1974, but sometime very early in the century. What kind of a president will Gerald Ford be? In matters of foreign policy, he'll be very much like each of the last four presidents. He's an internationalist. He was born and raised in the town of Senator Vandenberg, one of the very first of the Republican internationalists who broke with the Borough Lodge traditions. He believes that America has legitimate interests throughout the world, and that we must have the military machine not only to protect ourselves but to protect those interests. He says very succinctly, his record says it at great length. In that first joint speech to a joint session of Congress, he said, "A strong defense is the surest way to peace. Strength makes detente. Weakness invites war." He will fight for a strong army. He'll be concerned for the American position internationally. He will resist the pressures of our isolationist left, which sees only the city and its problems, race and their problems, and not how these problems interrelate with oil and wheat and all of the larger international issues. As far as Israel is concerned, again, he will be in line with the last four presidents of the United States who have supported Israel because Israel is part of the geopolitical scheme by which America develops its security. Unlike Mr. Nixon, Mr. Ford is an open man who does not have stereotypes about Jews, at least they're not very visible. He's a decent human being. I doubt that he will utter anti-Semitic expletives in the tapes, if there are tapes still rolling in the White House. He's had a long record of voting for foreign aid for Israel, of opposing pressure by the United States government against Israel when Russia was piling in its weaponry into Syria and into Egypt. He has understood the problems of Israel in the Middle East, but he has never visited the Middle East. And his interests have been those of all who were in this particular group of anti-communist, pro-American strength internationalists within the Republican Party. He comes to office at a time when it is very clear that America must do a good bit of soul-searching about not only its international commitments, but how it's going to handle its own well-being at home. He comes at a time when the lessons of geopolitics, that there's an oil weapon and a wheat weapon, as well as the announced positions of governments about freedom or peace or communism spreading throughout the world, very clear to most of us. And what is not clear is that he has the advisors or has himself an understanding of the complex and very difficult interrelationships of all of these factors. There's a danger that because of their complexity, he may fall, as did General Eisenhower, another essentially disinterested man, under the control of a John Foster Dulles. But he is a decisive man. If you present him with a neat case and it becomes consensus opinion among his advisors, he will move heaven and earth for it. What disturbs most subtle Americans, most who are aware of the complexities of modern life, is the tendency of Gerald Ford to offer homespun, even corny wisdom as solution to complex economic problems. Somehow, to most of us, the solution to the oil crisis or to inflation or to the recession does not lie simply with our putting on warmer clothing and keeping our thermostats down. It does not lie with putting on win buttons or planting victory gardens or organizing carpools. This seems somewhat corny, given the complexities of the issues and given the need for leadership for pro-economic and political planning at the top. We're not even sure that Mr. Ford has yet understood that the issue is more complex than what he's called public enemy number one, inflation. The terrible increasing cost of food and rent and a all the basic necessities of life. This he has understood. After all, his wife goes shopping. Or she did until she became the first lady. What he has not understood is that this seems to be a very complex economic movement, which includes not only worldwide inflationary pressures, but recessional pressures. Loss of production. Loss of real wages. Loss of foreign markets. A negative balance of trade. That all of these issues must somehow be blended, and that we simply today can't fight inflation because of it. We are also in a recession. Recession requires other kinds of economic palliatives or solutions. His approach to these problems so far has been relatively modest, and to provide us what are essentially intellectual circuses, a series of invited speakers from business, from labor, from the academic world, from the consumer world, who one by one, without any dialogue or any relationship really, appear before a Washington panel or elsewhere around the country and make their special presentations. It gives the illusion of a grand national meeting without there really being the meeting. Because what there must be is a proposal or a set of proposals. And then these must be chewed over by the various sections of our economy, by various people who know what economics is all about, and then there must be some consensus and then some proposal to Congress. This kind of sequential wisdom is no wisdom at all, but really only the presentation of various position papers by special interest groups. What he has proposed so far, a 5% surtax, a modest public works project when our unemployment figure reaches 6%, things of this type will not, in most opinions of those who understand these issues, be sufficient. What is not clear is whether, given his 1920 background, given his innate conservatism, his fear of government regulation, his innate preference for the free marketplace, which means the unshackling of business, whether he is prepared to demand of business and of labor, of all sections of the American economy, the controls, the restrictions, which alone can dampen inflation, hopefully restrict a down curve which is recessional. At the same time, I must say that I find something extremely sanguine and hopeful in the very homey and corny kinds of presentations that Gerald Ford has made. I have listened now to my friends for a decade bemoan the imperial presidency. And I presume that they meant, for certainly I meant, something more than the drums and the bugles and the side boys all dressed up that Richard Nixon loved to have around him. I felt they meant that in a democracy, responsibility must be broadly shared by Congress and the administration, by state governments and Congress and the administration, by local governments, state governments, Congress and the administration, by the citizenry, individually and generally, and all these other layers of government. I felt that they were saying that there's been a flow of power to one office, which is very dangerous in a democracy, because it means that the individual rights and consequently the responsibilities of the individual citizen are diminished and curtailed. Here we have a man who, whatever else he will be or will not be an imperial president. Here we have a man who, whatever else he will be or will not be a demagogue, who says, here are all the answers, only give me the power and I'll give you prosperity. What he's saying in his own corny way to us is that inflation is our responsibility as well as the government. We're greedy. We live like no Caesar ever lived. We want bigger profits and more luxuries and bigger homes and bigger cars every year. And it's the bigger car which has an impact on the energy crisis. It's the bigger home which has had an impact on the environment. The greater profits which has had an impact right down the line in terms of inflation. He's saying to us, not well, but saying to us nevertheless, if you want to solve the problems Don't turn only to some man on the white horse. Forget all this talk I hear about finding great leadership. This will be the solution from our problem. How many discussions have you been in lately in which everybody around the table bemoaned the lack of political leadership of some imaginary quality in the United States? As though that, the emergence of such a leadership would solve all of our problems. A man who has power simply has powers which no longer belong to us. Yes, we need imaginative leaders who can think through on the highest level these economic and international problems and make proposals. And then we must share in the decision-making and share in the sacrifices and the taxes and the other obligations which each decision entails. And that, to my mind, is what Gerald Ford is saying to us. That ultimately the strength of America is not whether or not some presidential candidate in 1976 will present us a blueprint for guaranteed prosperity, provided only we will give over our rights, or some measure of them, to him, to his administration. It lies in the fact of whether Americans are willing to wrestle now with all that is implied in the lowering of expectations. If we're willing to live with less well. We're willing to think of our children living with less than we have enjoyed. We're willing to pay the taxes for the controls of environment. We're willing to pay the costs of controlling pollution. We're willing to turn down the lights and turn down the heat and live not as hothouse orchids, but as ordinary human plants in this green world of God. Gerald Ford will challenge America on that very private level. Hopefully, he will challenge America also with plans and programs which will solve some of the very basic structural and legal issues which now becloud and make difficult any solution to our economic problems. Although in the second case, the answer, of course, is not yet in. We pray for this man who has assumed high office. But let's not hope for too much from him. There's very little in his past which would cause us to have overly high expectations. I read to you this morning from the book of Samuel the story in which the sons of Samuel, having proven greedy men, callous men, and men who perverted justice, the people turned to Samuel and demand of him a king. Samuel tries to urge them to maintain the old tribal confederation, where judges judged and the people, the tribes, were ultimately sovereign. God, speaking through Samuel, warns the people of what the consequences of turning their lives over to some royal authority. He will conscript your young men. He will use your young women for his court. He will demand a tenth of all you produce. He will demand the best of your lands, the best of your harvest. Ancient Israel could not resist, ultimately, the need for some strong central authority, the desire common to most people to have someone else solve the problems for them so they can go along with the ordinary decisions of ordinary living. I hope and pray that in the next months and years, for as long as Gerald Ford is our president, we will listen not with amusement, seriously, the very homey part of his speeches. And he will take to heart what he's saying from the bottom of his heart. That ultimately, the strength of America, our ability to solve our problems, depends on each and every one of us. And yes, we must do some little things, and yes, we must elect men who are competent and sensitive enough to do the big ones. Let's avoid this contemporary tendency to demand of the Samuels about us a king, some great statesman who will suddenly solve all of our problems. There are no great statesmen, only men, some wiser, some less wise. There are no panaceas. Our world is going through a basic economic transformation, and the cost must come out of the fat which has surrounded the Western economies. We must be prepared for the times. We can only pray that Mr. Ford will prepare himself for the very special responsibilities in these times, which will be his. Amen.